We're back on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe with my second guest, Kathy Kelly, who's speaking to us from San Francisco this morning. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning. Thank you, Hollis.
Thank you. Kathy is co-coordinator of an organization called Voices for Creative Nonviolence. And for more than 30 years, she's been working as a peace activist. And since the 1990s, her work has focused primarily on countries in the Middle East. Kathy has done this work at great personal risk and was imprisoned twice in the United States for her activism, including a year-long federal imprisonment for planting corn at a nuclear site. Kathy's going to talk Tuesday, April 22nd, that's next Tuesday at 7 p.m. at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation at Barcelona in Galisteo. So, Kathy, welcome, and please give us a little background on your organization, Voices for Creative Nonviolence.
So the antecedents of our organization were people who went over to Iraq to bring medicines to children and families in Iraq, and it was considered criminal by the United States government. We didn't believe what we did was criminal. We thought the economic sanctions against Iraq were criminal, and we broke those sanctions as often as we could. We organized 70 delegations to Iraq, and I guess I went over there about 26 times. And when the shock and awe bombing seemed inevitable, then we decided, okay, we'll stay. We couldn't imagine leaving people who'd given us so much hospitality and warmth, really. So we stayed through the shock and awe bombing and into the first years of the occupation. The situation in Iraq became so very, very terrible with kidnappings and death squads and massacres, and we realized that our presence was actually endangering families on the same street where we lived. So we did kind of wrap up that house that we had. It was a valiant effort. But we certainly haven't severed relationships with people in Iraq, but we also have, in the last 4 years, been much more active going back and forth to Afghanistan and trying to learn about the consequences of U.S. warfare there and in neighboring Pakistan. I guess it's just a matter of trying to address the consequences of U.S. militarism in a way that will help people better understand the people who are trapped, who can't leave war zones.
So, You go over, and in some cases you take medicine or supplies that you can give to people. And then...
Well, I should clarify, in Iraq we did that. In Afghanistan, we bought a lot of books over there and helped the Afghan peace volunteers set up a library, but we haven't bought medicine.
Uh-huh. And so you're really mainly gathering information?
Yeah, it sounds like we're an intelligence agency, doesn't it? But we do want people to feel more empathy for people who can't escape our bombs, our surveillance, our upheaval that's been caused because of United States military interventions and occupations.
So what is that like? Explain how you have been going to Afghanistan, where you live, what you do, what it's like on a daily basis.
Well, in a working class area of Kabul, there's a kind of an eclectic set of housing. You can see a poppy palace just recently built by a drug lord in one part of the neighborhood, and then desperately poor women who will cheerfully be part of a women's cooperative of seamstresses, hoping they might be able to get stale bread and tea without sugar for their families right next door. So we live in this working class area. A group of youngsters who come from different parts of Afghanistan, Pashto, Hazara, and Tajik, have decided to live together as a community. And we found that it's actually less expensive for us to rent out an apartment for them year-round than to pay the exorbitant prices of guest houses.
So this is the group called the Afghan Peace Volunteers?
That's right.
And they're mostly young people.
Oh, yes. The seamstresses are perhaps 30 years and up primarily, and they're very much a part of the community. I mean, I should say that the average lifespan for women in Afghanistan is between, the estimate is 44 to 48 years of age.
Wow.
And then the teenagers are, I mean, nobody really knows how old they are. in general, especially if they're from the rural areas, because they didn't have habits of issuing birth certificates, especially if it was a midwife who assisted with the birth or no midwife at all. But they're in their early to late teens. A few of the people in the community are actually attending university now. And then there are street children who come who are very young, very little kids who are working, you know, they are the main income earners for their families. And they come now to try to get back into some kind of education life. Most of them are people who fled from their homes because of war and violence, or because they couldn't farm their lands, or because they couldn't, graze their flocks because of the war and because of violence. So the children become the income earners, and the Afghan Peace Volunteers now are assisting 20 of them to go back to some kind of schooling, get remedial help if they're very, very behind in their learning of alphabet and times tables. So, and then we get them warm clothing for winter and oil and food for their families.
So let me clarify. So these are children. So a mother or even two parents and children might migrate from their rural home or their home in some village in a rural area to Kabul because they have no way to get food or to get their basic needs met where they lived. And then once in Kabul, everyone in the family is trying to find work, including these very young children who are out on the street working. And it's those children and their families that you're trying to help so the children can go back to school. Right?
That's true. Now, I should certainly clarify that we're just helping 20 children, and there are 60,000 child laborers in Kabul alone, an estimate of 600,000 in the country. And some people might be qualified as economic refugees, no other reason. They just can't make it economically. But Amnesty International said in late 2012 that there are 400 refugees every single day that crowd into already overcrowded cities, and they're fleeing violence. And it's sort of a curious situation. If a drone flies over your compound where you live and you're a goat herder, that in itself could be incentive to flee.
Yes.
Because the Taliban might say the reason these intelligence unmanned aerial vehicle drones are flying over this compound is because you must have given some kind of intelligence to some kind of information gatherer about whereabouts of insurgent fighters. And so people then become very, very afraid that they might be attacked by the Taliban. Or suppose two Taliban fighters do knock on their door, or fighters for some other armed group, and say, you know, give us food, we're hungry. You can't send them to, you know, Motel 6 or the 7-Eleven, and there's nothing out there. And so they might say, yes, here's food, but then be very, very afraid that they'll be targeted as high-value targets by people who are flying remotely controlled vehicles overhead, and the people basically controlling those vehicles are in Creech Air Force Base in the United States. And how are they to distinguish?
Right.
Is that really a Taliban household?
So the ordinary person in these settings may be, it's sort of like they can't trust anyone. It sounds like.
The levels of mistrust are very, very high. That's true, and it's tragic. And so for these young people to say, we are not going to give in to the push toward revenge or retaliation, and we're going to try our best not to panic, is in itself such an exemplary act of courage. I mean, I happened to be in New York City on September 11th, and it was hard for people not to feel a sense of panic and outrage and desire for revenge. There were some very wonderful people who refuted that, but, you know, our whole country changed radically.
Yes.
But these youngsters are saying, no, we will not succumb to panic. We want to control our fears. I mean, they just went through being five blocks away from a five-hour gun battle, and they were scared. But I've watched them over ensuing weeks try to sort through their feelings and try to make reasonable decisions, and did they need to move or not move, cut programs back for a while, and it's been very difficult. But they have tried their best to be a supportive community to one another and keep in touch with internationals to the extent that it's prudent.
So you mentioned the Seamstress Project. Will you elaborate a little bit on that?
Well, mothers were coming to our household and saying with just great grief and sometimes tears, I think I'm losing my mind. And you'd ask why, and they'd say they couldn't feed their children. And it happened that prices were rising for even bread, in part because it was harder for people to plant the crops that could help people produce bread inside Afghanistan. And in some ways, the economic sanctions against Iran were causing fuel prices to rise there. And, you know, it had a trickle-down effect on import of wheat. Anyway, the women had no way to have a buffer and have extra money to pay a higher cost. And so we'd ask, well, what are you feeding your children? And they'd say, well, stale bread and tea without sugar for three meals a day, you know. So the young one said, well, what if you became a cooperative of seamstresses and see if we can take what you make and we'll try to sell it in the marketplace? Now, that's had limited success, very limited, to be honest, but we then realized that what they would really make, if they could make something for themselves and others, would be the very heavy blankets that really can be the difference between life and death in the cold Kabul and Afghan-wide winters. And, you know, they said every woman all across Afghanistan knows how to make these. If you can get the wool and the coverlet material, you stuff the coverlet with wool and you stitch it up, and this can make a big difference in the refugee camps where people are living under tarps. Plastic. So we've been so edified. In 2012, the women gathered together, and with the help of Afghan peace volunteers, they distributed free of charge 2,000 of these heavy blankets. And then this past winter, 3,000. And that's certainly inclusive of the generosity of activists in the United States and the United Kingdom and in Australia. And what people have done is donate the money to buy the materials and to pay a living wage to the seamstresses. And they represent these three different tribes that I mentioned, so that it's equally distributed as best we can amongst a variety of different people. But then the Afghan peace volunteers are young social workers. They go up the mountains and figure out who is a widow, where are the orphans, and who is living in a refugee camp, and, you know, set up dates for distribution. So it's been called the Duvet Project, and it's really been quite a good exercise, although it's just a drop in the bucket compared to the need.
Just so our new listeners know, I'm talking with Kathy Kelly. Kathy is a peace activist who has been to Afghanistan 12 times and stayed there with Afghani people and is talking to us about her experiences there. She's going to be talking at the Unitarian Universalist Church, 107 West Barcelona. That's the church at the corner of Barcelona and Galisteo, next Tuesday, April 22nd at 7 p.m. And the title of her talk is Seeing Through the Smokescreen, Eyewitness Accounts of War and Peace in Afghanistan. Kathy, talk a little bit about the reason you titled your topic that way.
Well, I think that many people in the United States have the impression that if the United States troops leave, we'll be leaving women and children very vulnerable to Taliban fighters and Taliban social codes, which are quite vicious toward women and dangerous for children. I myself don't at all want to say that there are people in Afghanistan who want to live under a Taliban rule. But I do want people to understand why it is that in the New York Review of Books, Anatole Levin said that the United States over the past 12 years has been subsidizing the Taliban. Now, that might sound crazy, but the truck-delivered supplies that have bought food and water and fuel and ammunition to every United States base, airfield, forward operating base, in some cases to people that are working as contractors for the United States. Those truck-delivered supplies have come in through Pakistan quite often, gone up through roadways in Pakistan, and many of those roadways are controlled by Pakistani Taliban fighters. Then they get into Afghanistan, and they're going along roadways controlled by Afghan Taliban or by militias organized by warlords. And so if a toll is paid on every single truck that passes, I mean, you can kind of imagine Easy Pass or whatever you have in New Mexico. But, well, that money doesn't go to the Afghan government necessarily. It goes to whatever warlord or drug lord controls the roadways.
Right.
Now, it's important to, I think, take a look at the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan's report, which says that in terms of non-military aid, the United States is now approaching having spent $100 billion in Afghanistan. Mm. But only $3 billion of that ever went to any kind of humanitarian aid. The other $97 billion has gone to things like counter-narcotics, and yet somehow 93% of the world's opium is coming from Afghanistan. And there are drones flying 12 hours a day, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Don't those drones ever collect footage that might show the movement of opium, convoys of opium going out of the country?
So
something,
Kathy,
is radically wrong.
Your point here being that the picture that we get in the United States, even by the best of media, is to a certain degree controlled by the U.S. government, and that what they tell us is only part of the picture, and perhaps in some cases even obfuscation.
Well, you know, consider, for instance, if the U.S. public understood that the cost of maintaining one soldier in Afghanistan for 1 year, one U.S. soldier, is now $2.1 million.
Where does that figure come from?
The cost, the Special Inspector General report on Afghanistan, and you could just Google cost of U.S. soldier Afghanistan, and you'll get multiple media reports that back up that statistic. Last year it was $1 million per soldier per year. It jumped up because the United States is now spending enormous sums of money to truck the supplies out of Afghanistan. But where does that money go? This is why I'm emphasizing that the roadways are controlled. But also, it's kind of imagine Lady Justice in the scales. And on one scale is the $2.1 million per soldier per year sum. The cost to get iodized salt into the diet of a child in Afghanistan who is starving. And 1 million children in Afghanistan are now suffering from severe acute malnourishment. The cost to get just the salt into the diet of a child over the course of 1 year would be a nickel, 5 cents. Now, what would most people you know choose?
Mm-hmm. So in your efforts to change, to inform the U.S. public, and to perhaps change our minds or help us understand better what the impacts of the war are on ordinary civilians in Afghanistan, what's the long-term goal here?
Well, of course, the long-term goal is to abolish war, to accomplish what was accomplished by the people who abolished slavery, to say this institution is so obsolete, so flawed, so wrongful, so insupportable. And if we look at the United States war in Iraq, the United States war in Afghanistan, what has happened in Libya, we simply can't find anything that creates security for people in the country where we've invaded or occupied. The only security is for the people who are the war profiteers.
Can't
say that U.S. security is heightened when people in other parts of the world view the United States as a menacing, plundering force. I mean, what's in Afghanistan? Some of the resources that are so precious that are used in our cell phones, in our laptops, the rare earth elements, the lithium, and also copper and iron ore are under the Hindu Kush Mountains in Afghanistan. Go to the Caspian Sea Basin and you'll find one of the richest deposits of natural gas and fossil fuels. Whichever country constructs and controls the roadways, the railways, and the pipelines for extraction of such valuable resources, country that, you can talk about the Asia pivot, will have an upper edge. The United States doesn't want China or Russia to have that upper edge. And so for hard, cold, and I think cruel gains, the United States has continued warfare in Afghanistan, exacerbated it. And we're not leaving. The United States is going to keep at least 9 military bases and forward operating bases and 3 airfields, and I believe 3 prisons. Once the bilateral security agreement is signed, and it's almost certain as soon as a new president is elected, that president, in concert with the elites that have been controlling Afghanistan throughout, including U.S. elites, corporate elites, they'll sign that agreement, and the extraction will be made more plausible. But there's no concern for the widows and orphans.
Yeah, talk to me about that.
For the hungriest.
What is life like for a widow and who has children in Afghanistan?
Well, if you're lucky enough not to be in a refugee camp, then most likely you'll go up a mountainside to find the cheapest rent. And it's cheaper going up the mountainside because there's no water. There are no pipes, and so the landlords can't charge as much. So you'll wake up early in the morning, and maybe your children are really near the conditions of freezing to death, and you have to try to get some hot water. So you go down the mountainside. Now, don't imagine there's a road. You're picking your way down a mountainside, and it's icy and rutted, and you've got a container. You fill that container up at the bottom of the mountain with as much water as you can carry. You put that on your head, and you make your way back up the mountain. Your body is frail. You're old. You're worn. Then when you get up to the top, you've got what's called a bukhari, a very small tin stove, and you feed into it all day long almond shells that you use for fuel after you've spent your day shelling almonds. And then you sell almonds in the marketplace, and that's your income. And you maybe have a latrine, or perhaps you have to go to the side of a mountain. It's a very, very rough life. And your hope is that your child can go to school. But if you're desperate, you say to your child, I'm sorry, you can't go to school. You have to try and weave this rug all day long, and maybe we'll augment our income.
Kathy,
and the United States...
Go ahead.
Well, I just want to say, the United States has claimed that it has made it more possible for girls to go to school. But when you look at the statistics about how many girls actually finish the year in school, or the half year that they are in school. They just don't have school in the winter months because it's just too cold. It's about 6%.
Hmm. So, Kathy, you told me 61. Hope you don't mind me telling the entire world that.
No, that's fine.
You have been doing this work on the ground in countries in the Middle East for a very long time. I jotted down the other day when we were talking, you've been in Israel, Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Bosnia, spent not too much time here at home in the United States. And most of that time you've been confronted with the ravages of war on innocent populations. How do you keep doing this work?
Well, I think the shorthand is just fall in love. You fall in love with people who are interesting and generous and kindly. And I guess I also think that here in the United States there's a kind of a war going on against impoverished people here. If you go to the prisons and go to the jails, go to the economically disadvantaged and underserved areas, then you'll see the people who are bearing the brunt of this kind of militarism here at home. And so I don't really sense, okay, I'm in this country, I'm in that country. I think we've got more in common with one another. I like the idea the Afghan peace volunteers promote of being border-free. So, I'm not sure I want to say my home is here, my home is there. Uh-huh. I think Thomas Paine had it right. My country is the world, my religion is to do good. And I think a lot of people aspire toward that and believe in it. And, one thing about our new technologies is it is a shrinking planet in some ways. Unfortunately, with shrinking resources because we're using them so unwisely. But who can we learn from? We can learn so much of what we need to know, not from what the drones will collect with miles and miles of footage taken by surveillance cameras, but from trying to listen to people who just want to be able to feed their families.
And so, in your talk, is there anything you're going to address in your talk that we haven't touched on today?
Well, I'll be so grateful to have a chance to think about the activism that does go on all the time in our neighborhoods and what kinds of things we can do to be supportive, to link, unite our struggles with one another. There are many, many anecdotes to be told about people whom I've met in Afghanistan and Iraq. And also, you know, the United States is allied with Israel, and we just have to acknowledge that Israel has used conventional warfare against civilian populations in Gaza and engaged in an illegal occupation of land belonging to people who are constantly being pushed back, shoved off their land. I'm referring to Palestinians. And so I want to make sure that people who come are aware of the campaigns going on in their own local neighborhoods and universities and faith-based groups.
And so, in a final little moment here, what would you tell people to do? How can we not be overwhelmed by the enormity of the problem? What action can we take?
Well, I think if you spread the peanut butter too thin, the bread rips. I think each of us has to figure out, you know, what really does enliven my passions, my desires to make a better world. And then try as much as we can to align our lives with our values and really try to insulate ourselves against getting too distracted by sports and entertainment, for instance. And, you know, really look at our day and evaluate, okay, what can I do with this day that will really help create a better world for the children I love, for the grandchildren I love? Mm. And I think one good thing to do is just go to the nearest soup kitchen.
Go to the nearest house
of hospitality. You know, rub shoulders with the people that are doing that, and it'll get more clear.
Thanks so much.
About what way to take.
Thank you so much, Kathy. I've been talking with Kathy Kelly of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Their website is vcnv.org. Kathy is speaking Tuesday, April 22nd at 7 p.m. at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation at the corner of Barcelona and Galisteo. You can hear her talk about seeing through the smokescreen, eyewitness accounts of war and peace in Afghanistan. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Hollis Walker, sitting in for Mary Charlotte.